2 Romeo India Whiskey. Whiskey. My name is Dick, and we're going to begin the tech nap as we have for 33 approximate years. September 1982 is the very first tech nap. It's a gathering of the ham radio population that has curiosity. They want to know more about how their equipment works, so they ask questions and usually get answers. Not always, but it's peer-reviewed material to some degree. By that I mean you have, let me drop it.
Net time.
We have a very enthusiastic person who, KC2NJI, Mike number one, who records all the technets and puts them on a website. You can go to that website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can play back the last 10 years of technet. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and there's the technet to be downloaded to whatever kind of audio equipment you've got, if that's what you want to do. Some people can't stay up as late as this technet lasts. It's an unusual technet because people do have that much curiosity. It's slowly over the years developed into a four-hour technet, starting at 8 and ending at midnight. Not everybody can stay up that late. So stay up as late as you can and then listen to the rest of it. It gets each week's technet gets applied to that particular website a few days downrange. And there's a second website that has additional material that complements the technet, and that's at landmarktechnet.com by Mike number two. So by way of those two websites, you can get additional information, photographs, graphs, and whatever. Things like Smith chart and the Brown and Woodward curves and other things like that. My job. We have a rather loose schedule that we follow, and if you think we're using the wrong schedule, you're allowed to make suggestions as to how it should be changed. That's what we have developed over the years, the current loose schedule in which during the first hour we take check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in just because you're listening. After 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So if you have a question or a comment, you give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning I do have a question or a comment for the net. And we do that for approximately the first hour. Although there are times where if we get onto a really hot and heavy subject that people are very enthusiastic about, there's nothing magic about that exact hour. It has sometimes gone a heck of a lot longer, occasionally a little bit shorter, but usually a heck of a lot longer than that period of time has occasionally occurred. Let me drop. After the first hour or so, John, KC2WGB, gives us his read of the mailbag. He occasionally gets as many as 76 replies during the week of people who don't yet have their equipment to talk to us directly, don't yet have the right ham license, and they're working on it, and they've got a question about any subject of interest to ham radio operators. So they communicate with John, KC2WGB. By way of QRZ.com, you can find his email address, and he also announces it. So he chooses a couple of questions that he thinks have a general interest, and we discuss those. John simultaneously monitors the Echo Link and IRLP, and if you have trouble checking in because we're too quick on the switch and don't wait for the all four beeps, let me drop. So we don't wait for all four beeps. John, by way of monitoring the Echo Link, he knows about that, brings it to our attention, and it gets corrected. So if you can't get through immediately and you're using Echo Link, don't worry, John will know about it. Although I did hear John having a little bit of trouble checking into Echo Link tonight for the first time, but that's probably going to be corrected.
Yes, Dick, Eric is working on it. It's not up yet.
So in quite a few years that you're flying blind, John, where the Echo Link is not there for you to monitor. Is that approximately true? KC2WGB for some comments. K2RIW.
Absolutely correct. I don't think we've ever had a loss during the TechNet other than a minor interruption, something, you know, just had a restart or something. But Echolink didn't go down. This time it looks like Echolink itself is down, but should be taken care of fairly rapidly. Chat room's working fine.
Okay, let's see what Eric's got to say. Eric's in the process of checking on the status of our Echolink. KE2EJ, KE2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
It's running now.
Okay, so that part is operational. After the mailbag function, the next thing that happens is that Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us the latest on what's going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And this week, you've been hearing about a very unusual situation of all the stars that are out there that have planets. And we've discovered about 3,000 of those planets going around other stars. Most of them are many light years away, real long distances. The very closest star to Earth is the star called Proxima Centauri, right alongside of Alpha Centauri. I think it's a binary star system. And lo and behold, they found out that that particular star not only has a planet, but it looks like that planet's in the Goldilocks zone. So maybe we're extremely lucky that the closest possible star just happens to have a planet that maybe is in a Goldilocks zone. We're not home free yet, though, because that's a red dwarf star, and the planet is so close to it that a one-year period is only a few days, something like 11 or 12 days, I think it is. So there's an extra danger that the planet experiences when it's that close to a star, even though it's a small red dwarf star. You still have ultraviolet radiation and things like that to worry about. So is life on that planet? Well, by the time the Webb Space Telescope is operational, let me drop. The new Webb Space Telescope, which is due to be launched in 2018, it possibly has the ability to view that planet directly, measure its atmosphere and things like that. So exciting things are happening with reference to looking for life elsewhere in the universe. Is the Earth the only place that life exists? Very unlikely that that situation is just one planet that has life, if you know what I mean. There's lots of evidence that there's probably a tremendous number of planets that have life. Not that they're close to us, not that it's easy to communicate with them. We can't easily go there, but quite possibly we're not alone. We'll be hearing more about that. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins by people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters and your name and the word yes. A typical check-in would sound like this. KE2J, KE2EJ, Eric, and yes. So right now give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
Duke, if I may, I'd like to put a quick call to Paul.
Go right ahead, Eric. I mean, John. You got it, John.
WS2N, KC2WGB. Are you there yet, Paul?
WGB, WS2N, I'm here. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Paul. I was just checking to see if you received my email to you about that question we had last week. Dr. Roy found a fully matured article about it, which I sent it over to you. The one I saw was the first draft, and it was a very short article. This one had a little more information. I was just wondering if you did receive it.
Yeah, I did, and I put it down for tonight's net. Yeah, at first I did get one from Roy, and then a day or so later, yours showed up. So, very good. Back to you, John.
Very good. Just wanted to check. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
You've heard those two guys talk about Dr. Roy. AC2 Golf Sierra, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra is the Roy we're talking about, who who is a physician, and he's also a guy with lots of experience with reference to space-type things and science in general. We quite often use him as an anchor point as to whether or not somebody's theory possibly holds water or is pretty crazy. So he's one of the people we go to for checks from time to time. Okay, you guys who are do have questions or comments, you're going to give me your call letters and your name right now. Try to remember to wait for the beeps in between. K2RI, be listening for those check-ins.
KC2PYT, Ed, yes.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
Those are two very proper check-ins. Absolutely the correct way to do it. Ed PYT and Joe QIW. Well done. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW. Wait for the beeps.
And to XCN with yes.
We got Wes. And one last call. Anyone to check in with question or comment for the net? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW. Okay, we have more than enough to get going. And Ed, unless I've got you confused with someone else, I believe you've moved into a new QTH. And possibly putting up some fancy antennas, if the landlord lets you do that. KC2PYT. K2RIW, you got it, Ed.
KC2PYT, as it happens, I just did move, and my question is related to the putting up of antennas. In particular, I've been reading up on maximum permissible exposure, and I learned some things that surprised me a little bit, and so I have some questions to you since I'm in an apartment complex, and most of the surrounding volume of space is uncontrolled territory. I have some questions about the practice of checking your field strength output, and sort of questions as to whether people actually do this as routinely as they're supposed to. I'm going to let it drop for a second. Reading the FCC guidelines, it appears that routine exposure evaluation is mandatory above certain power transmission thresholds. In particular, for VHF, if you are transmitting at above 50 watts, you have to do routine evaluations in the uncontrolled areas around your antenna to make sure that a person can't accidentally wander in and get hurt by your radio emissions. So my question is, do people actually do this the way they're supposed to? And if they do it, how do they go about doing it in terms of equipment use and the actual practice of measuring this stuff?
Yeah, I wonder if you're coming in by EchoLink. The fact that I only heard one beep. Also, your audio is a tiny bit low. Dipole, a end-fed zip, a long wire. The signal comes off that wire and radiates in all directions at once. It radiates in all directions at once. Therefore, the process got to become RF radiation. Perfectly good word. You heard me say it so often until nuclear radiation came along. Nuclear radiation consists of literally particles, atomic-sized particles coming off at close to the speed of light from your radioactive material, and those particles are like micro-miniature bullets as they penetrate your skin. They're capable of doing damage, capable of changing the status of your...
Repeater, time out.
Those microscopic bullets are capable of changing the status of your protoplasm, changing your DNA, possibly initiating a cancer. So nuclear radiation is something to have a very healthy respect for. But unfortunately, RF energy has no particles. There are people who will give you a little bit of a flack on that one because when it comes to certain kinds of electromagnetic energy, is it particle or is it a wave? 99.99% of what a radio wave is a wave. It's not a particle. And so it doesn't have that capability. The defining document for the United States is the ANSI report, American National Standard Institute, ANSI. It's the C95 report. That report is something that is updated every couple of years for the last 60 years or so. It's a 60-year continuously developing document, which contains something like 1,000 references. Those 1,000 references represent the best testing laboratories, the best universities in the United States, as well as other places around the world. Let me drop it. So the American National Standard Institute, which is connected to the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, have been studying radio energy and its effect on human beings for more than 60 years. Very smart people, lots of countries. The United Kingdom has a similar document, so does Australia and so on. Many, so does Japan, have a very similar document. Not an easy document to read. And once you know that you're looking for the American National Standard Institute C95 report, you Google those words in various combinations. You will eventually find a thoroughly free download where you can read the thing. You'll find some websites that try to sell it to you, but others will eventually give you a copy free of charge. As I said, it's not easy to read, but once you do start reading it, understand it. What does it say? For instance, the thing that everybody's afraid of is the zillions of self-site base stations we've got all over the world, and various municipalities have set crazy rules. Let me drop it. Hempstead Town, for instance, and Huntington Town, copied Hempstead and set a so-called 500-foot rule. You're not allowed to establish a brand new cell site base station any closer to a residence, school, or place of worship than 500 feet. And where in the world did that number 500 feet come from? Well, Hempstead hired a not so straight consultant who knew what Hempstead wanted to hear, so he set the number at 500 feet. He set the number, didn't calculate it, didn't read the reference and come up with that. He set the number of 500 feet because he knew that he wanted to hear that. Second of all, he knew that would guarantee a whole lot of business for him in the future, because anybody who wants to set up a brand new cell site, every cell site is going to be violating the 500-foot rule, no matter where you put it, in a place like Hempstead or Huntington Town. So obviously they're going to be going back to him and saying that, well, the best site we can find is 361 feet away from a school. Let me drop. So obviously Hempstead Town in that hypothetical situation I just said would go back to that consultant and say, is 361 feet okay? To which he would say, all right, give me some money and I'll study it. And I'll get back to you on that. So he's got guaranteed business. The number should have been 5 feet. The real distance that's slightly dangerous from a cell site is 5 feet, not 500 feet. the naivete of Hempstead Town when they hired this consultant is that they hired a consultant, he gave them a number, they checked that off on their list as, okay, we got a consultant, he gave us a number, now we can go on and find out how many cell sites we can establish. Well, the answer is zero with that crazy rule. If Hempstead Town had been doing their job, they would have said back to that consultant, okay, how did you calculate or how did you derive the number 500 feet? They should have asked him that question. Okay, so you can tell there's a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to radio frequency biohazard assessment. The FCC people, you've got a problem with the FCC in that it's a revolving door of people who are really attorneys. Arguably the best FCC commissioner we've ever had was the man named Newton Minow. Somewhere in the mid-60s, he was the commissioner for the FCC. And he's the guy who really did some good work for the FCC for the 2.5 years he was there. He was by far the best ever had, and why was he only there for 2.5 years? And the answer is, he was starving to death. Let me drop.
EPZ with a comment.
Okay, you'll have to wait a little while, Hal, before I can get back to you on that one, because I'm in the middle of a story I'm trying to tell people, and they'd rather not interrupt it right in the middle. And that is that he was only there for 2.5 years, and now there's a PBS special telling you about Mr. Newton Minow. It was on over the last week, and the problem was that his salary as the commissioner of the FCC, controlling all the broadcast stations and all the licenses for all the radio systems in the United States, his salary was $20,500 per year. He was living below the poverty level, so to speak. He could only do that for 2.5 years, and he had to go out and get a real job. So we've got this revolving door of FCC commissioners because they're so underpaid. And how in the world the United States hasn't realized what's going on and why we can't keep a good FCC commissioner when we get one is because we pay them so poor. We pay them less than we pay a teacher, if you know what I mean. So, therefore, the FCC doesn't have a coherent story when it comes to radio frequency biohazard. So they... You get a brand new commissioner comes along who barely understands the physics involved, and he comes up with a set of rules where amateur radio operators are supposed to study everything they do to make sure they're not creating a radio frequency biohazard. Let me interrupt here for a second. If you've got a brief comment on what we said so far, Hal, go right ahead. K6DPZ, K2RIW, there's a lot more to the story.
RIW, yeah, I just wanted to say, Dick, they're engineers for the town of Hempstead. They're a bunch of jerks. And you know why. What happened to me. So that's my comment. They're a bunch of jerks. They're underpaid. They all know what they're doing. Quote, unquote. I can tell more about that. Go ahead, pick it up, Dick. Finish up the story. K6DPZ.
Hey, to the jet. Yeah, let's see what you've got to add to this before we proceed, Eric. Because I think you've lived near some of these districts that have got these crazy sets of rules. KE2EJ, K2IW. And Eric, by the way, being our broadcast engineer for Channel 13 in New York City, Channel 21 out here on Long Island. And in the days of Newton Minow being the FCC commissioner in the early 1960s, what he was doing to really put teeth into the FCC is that each broadcast license in those years, when it came up for renewal, let me drop. The aware person of the broadcast station had to prove to the FCC that they were serving the community's interest. That's what the FCC used to demand. Well, so since then, they've become somewhat of a toothless tiger. Things like that are no longer required. But you being in the world of broadcast all of these years of your life, Eric, I bet you've seen a tremendous amount of change in the philosophy and methods of doing business of the FCC versus broadcast stations. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
M2EO. Dick, could you add me to the question poll at the end?
You're on the list, not to worry. Go ahead, Eric.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, I wanted to say a couple things. Actually, the radioactive 1934 got severely modified. Actually started out during the Reagan years. The commissioners started becoming people who live in the cable industry.
actually, including last couple of commissioners. But one of the organizations which is on the side of us, so to speak, the sister organization is the SBE, the Society Broadcast Engineers, and they've put in a number of different documents for review, which essentially would assign an engineering personnel to a commissioner, because the commissioners in these days are lawyers, they are not technical people. So that's the push of the current day. By the way, 1996, Bill Clinton really killed a number of things in the Radio Act, including the fairness doctrine and a bunch of other stuff, but we don't have to get into that now. K2RW, K2HX.
Beautiful. You're slowly getting the impression, the picture, you guys, that if this is the best of all worlds, you would hire a man for the commissioner of the FCC who has a strong background in physics, lots of knowledge of radio, and a mediocre amount of knowledge as far as being an attorney is concerned. Well, we primarily get attorneys who have very little knowledge of physics and radio, and so therefore some of their decisions are not very good. The recent decision to demand that all commercial radio two-way systems be more narrowband FM, so that they would squeeze more of them into a given frequency spectrum. Good sounding idea on paper, really a bad idea. There's a whole bunch of reasons as to why those radios are not going to work as well as they think, and they're not going to get twice as many licenses issued in the same frequency regions, what they thought they were going to do. Anyhow, so there's a lot of disconnect in the way radio is being understood, studied, and the rules being set. So a commissioner came along saying that FCC is demanding that we amateurs calculate whether or not we're creating a radio frequency biohazard with our particular equipment. If you start studying our particular equipment and the way we use it, let me drop it. And you'll find out that 99% of the time, what we're doing is extremely safe. I mean, that great big piece of million-dollar hardware that's at each individual cell site base station, you know, it's a 100-foot tower with a whole bunch of equipment connected to it, and all of those things, all those antennas are communicating with, in theory, a large number of cell sites, a cell phone operator simultaneously. I mean, that looks like a dangerous piece of equipment reading a whole lot of signals all at once. And it has a dangerous range of 5 feet. You'd have to be on a 100-foot high hook and ladder of your local fire department, standing on the top of that ladder when they slowly wheel the truck up against the antenna, so that you're line of sight at the right altitude, 5 feet away, and even then you would be safe. The real number is around 3.5 feet, where you exceed a certain number of milliwatts per square centimeter. The main thing that the American National Standard Institute C95 report has discovered in 60 years of study is that when a radio signal hits a human being, the only thing they can confirm is it creates heating. Let me drop. You could say it's the exact same process as what goes on in your microwave oven. Your microwave oven puts a tremendous amount of power, something like 700 watts to 1,000 watts into a very small area, very small volume of that chamber where you put your hamburger or whatever you're cooking in your microwave oven. So you're really, literally cooking that thing with tremendous amount of power in a very small, extremely well-shielded structure where all the energy is bouncing back and forth, and you put a kilowatt of energy, RF energy, in there at 2,000 megacycles, the way the thing works. And by the way, the 2,000 megacycles is nothing magic about that frequency. They could have, some of the earliest microwave ovens operated at 27 megs, 600 megs, 2,000 megs, 5,000 megs. It happens to be a frequency left over that got assigned to microwave ovens. The very first frequency of resonance of water is about 22 gigahertz, so there's no fancy resonances going on. And there are people who make jokes about the microwave oven. I have nuked my food. And I literally got asked that question. Let me drop. A very well-respected electrical engineering consultant who is a fellow member of the organization I'm a member of,
the Long Island Consultants Network. He literally asked me one night, when I turned off my microwave oven and I start taking the food out, how long must I wait for the radiation to die down so that the food is safe for me to eat? He had heard so many people saying, I'm nuking my hamburger, and how long should I wait for the nuclear radiation to die down? He literally asked me that question because of the jokes people make, and he believed that was going on. He asked me, how long does it take for my food to cool off radio-wise? And the answer is roughly 1 nanosecond. At the instant the microwave oven turns off because of its timer, the magnetron is putting out 2,000 megahertz, and the very last cycle probably takes a nanosecond to die down. So it's the microwave tube in the microwave oven slowly settling down. That's the time you're waiting for. You can't possibly open the door that fast, if you know what I mean. So the food itself experienced heating, and the heating that experiences, whether you do it with a radio wave or whether you do it with an ordinary convection oven, other than there's a little bit of difference in depth of penetration of where the heating is taking place, it's still heating. So RF energy striking something like a human being creates nothing that has ever been confirmed other than heating. So now you have to worry about how close are you to a microwave source, how much heat is it creating, and can that particular portion of your body tolerate that amount of heat? Let me drop. Thermally speaking, the most sensitive part of your body is the human eye, because the human eye has a very slow rate of fluid flow. It doesn't have great big arteries and veins going through it, so the rate of fluid flow through the eye is very slow. On top of that, if you overheat your cornea or your lens, you could create a cataract. So the numbers that used to be used for a zillion years, so to speak, of the C95 report was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, which already had a 10-to-1 safety factor built into it. They literally took a white rabbit, tied him into a structure, held his eye open, and exposed him to radio energy, stronger and stronger, till you found out when the rabbit's eye was damaged. And it took more than 100 milliwatts per square centimeter to do that. So, and it took something like a 10-minute exposure at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. That's a really potent signal, if you go through the mathematics of what that means. So they set the number 10-to-1 safer than that at 10. Well, because of a whole bunch of conservative people worrying about things that haven't been confirmed, lately that number's been lowered to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. So something in the vicinity of 1 milliwatt per square centimeter at VHF frequencies. The lower frequencies, the RF energy goes through you and doesn't even create any heating. If you try to run a microwave oven at 3.5 megahertz or 80 meter handband, let me drop. There's something about the way protoplasm behaves at 3.5 megacycles. Most of the energy would go right straight through without even being absorbed and creating any heating. The greatest amount of absorption is around the VHF frequencies between 300 and 3 gigahertz. Correction, 30 to 300. 30 to 300 megahertz is where RF energy is most efficiently absorbed by a human body. Above 300 megahertz, the energy starts bouncing off the surface and doesn't even penetrate. At 1500 megahertz and above, again, things get 10-to-1 safer because 10% of the energy is penetrated, 90% is reflected off. The microwave energies, everybody thinks microwave is much more dangerous. It's actually 10-to-1 safer than the VHF frequencies. So at VHF frequencies, depending on how much energy you're radiating and how close you are to the antenna, are you exceeding 1 milliwatt per square centimeter? Depending on whether or not it is a controlled environment, whether or not the person knows he's being exposed, or whether he doesn't know, you've got a couple of different sets of rules there. Let me drop. If you're putting, for instance, 1,000 watts into your 80-meter antenna, the 80-meter antenna is roughly 132 feet long, you could say to some degree, 1,000 watts is being radiated across that 132-foot length. And if you stood a couple of feet away from that dipole, the dipole is now operating, in my crazy example, 6 feet off the ground, and you're standing a couple of feet away from that dipole, and there'd be a little bit of difference as to whether or not you're near the tip of the dipole or near the center. But because the because the 80 meter energy at 3.5 megacycles goes through you with so little effect, the majority of it doesn't even stop in creating the heating. You could be a couple of feet away from that dipole, radiating a kilowatt heat down continuously, and you would be safe. If you're now taking 1,000 watts into a 432 megacycle dipole, and you stand close to it, which you shouldn't do, yes, now you can create some heating, because the antenna is much smaller, it's more of a point source, therefore the local E-field is stronger. Calculating local E-field is a little bit difficult. Measuring it is a little bit difficult. Let me drop it. You can go out and buy a machine which will tell you at this particular frequency region over which it's rated how many volts per meter, what is the E-field strength. You can buy a machine that will give you volts per meter and you find out whether or not you're exceeding that. Because of the craziness of radio energy, whether or not you're measuring it as power in milliwatts per square centimeter, whether you're measuring it in E-field in volts per meter, whether you're measuring it in magnetic field in amps per meter, these are the units. There's at least three different kinds of instrumentation you could use, three different sets of readings. If you read the nitty-gritty of the ANC report and the FCC requirements, if you calculate it accurately in volts per meter, or if you calculate it accurately or measure it accurately in milliwatts per square centimeter, in either case, you've made the measurement. And if you've done it right, you don't have to use all three. But in theory, you're responsible for this jazz. So, as I said, if you're putting a kilowatt into a dipole at 432 or at 2 meters, and you stand a foot away from it, you've exceeded the 10 milliwatts or the 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. And by the way, to heat a human eye to the point where you might get a cataract, let me drop. It takes 6 minutes. You'd have to operate your radio. You're standing in the wrong place, so to speak. You're too close, and you're running the thing key down for 6 solid minutes, and now you get some heating of the eye if you're too close. And the eye, as I said, is the most sensitive part of your body that we know about. And the eye has got a thermal time constant. You can't boil a pot of water on the stove instantaneously. You can't heat up your eye instantaneously. So the amount of power averaged over a 6 minute period is the way the ANSI report operates, is the way the FCC rules operate, the way ham radio operators operate. If you're calculating whether or not what you're doing is dangerous, as I said, we're on the hook for the responsibility to make sure we're not exceeding any of these numbers. But as I said, you've got to do something pretty darn foolish in order to once you understand the physics of what's going on, very few of us are doing anything that's dangerous. 30 to 300 megs is where you got to worry the most. If your handy-talky operating at the 450 megahertz handband is running more than 5 watts, and that rubber duck antenna is inches away from your forehead and your eye, you're getting relatively close to the milliwatts per square centimeter, where if you squeeze the transmit button on that handy-talky for 6 solid minutes, you're getting close to the point where it represents a potential danger to your eye. And so the more conservative Radio Society of Great Britain, let me drop. When you're operating a handy-talky, the more conservative Radio Society of Great Britain suggests that if you hold the handy-talky horizontal instead of vertical, don't worry about the fact that your repeater is vertically polarized. By the time that signal bounces off of all of the multipath objects in your environment and it gets between your transmitter and that receiving antenna at the repeater site, the holding the handy-talky horizontal doesn't mean the signal is going to get there as a purely horizontal signal, unless you're a very small distance away, line of sight, if you know what I mean. The signal is bouncing off of all kinds of things, and the polarization gets very randomized by the time it gets there. But if you hold your handy-talky horizontal, the rubber duck is now further away from your forehead, further away from your eyes, and it's a safer condition. And Radio Society of Great Britain, I could give you the chapter and verse of their particular section on radio biohazard, where they recommend you operate the handy-talky that way. If you want to go one step further, you use the speaker mic, and you hold the handy-talky further away from your eye when you're actually operating the radio itself. So 5 watts, inches away from a rubber duck to your eye, you're cross pulsing, you're right about at the threshold of the number of milliwatts per square centimeter in a 6-minute transmitting period, where potentially you create enough heating at the eye where you're getting close to the point where if you do it day in and day out, you might develop a cataract over that. That's the most dangerous thing that I can think of that we ham radio operators do. Let me drop. And whether or not the heating of the radio energy coming off that rubber duck, or whether or not it's the heating of the case of the handy talkie itself, if you're operating a 5-watt handy talkie and you're doing a whole lot of long transmitting, long key down transmitting, you'll recognize the fact that the dissipation of the final stage of the handy talkie is creating amount of heat, and so the metal clip on the back, which is the belt attachment device, it gets hot in your hand. So the heating you get off of a handy talkie, is it the physical heating of the case itself, or is it the radio energy coming off the rubber duck creating heating in your eye, which is the most dangerous, is an interesting thing to study, if you know what I mean. But one of your portions of your question, Ed, was how do I actually make the measurement? Let me drop it. Very few of us are going to go out and buy a radio frequency biohazard assessment meter. Let me think now. NADA made one. A couple of companies made one. They tend to be pretty expensive. And a meter that gives you direct reading in milliwatts per square centimeter or in volts per meter, as I said, they're kind of pricey. Very few hams have ever used one. Very few hams have access to one. A much easier technique is to take an antenna of known gain. With that antenna, you make a field strength measurement. If you know the gain of your antenna, and because gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared, there's an area relationship represented by the gain of your known antenna. So you're taking an antenna that operates at the frequency of interest, you make a field strength measurement at some reasonable distance. You gotta worry a little bit about the fact that if you're making a measurement in the so-called reactive near field, if you get too close to your source of energy with your antenna, the readings become a little bit crazy. There's a certain minimum distance that must exist between the antenna making the measurement and the thing that's doing the signal generating. Let me drop it. So once you know the frequency you're operating at, once you know the gain of the antenna you're using to monitor the signal, and once you now measure that signal strength in dBm, milliwatts, whatever, there is a not too difficult to understand calculation that tells you what is the field strength in whatever units you like. Milliwatts per square centimeter, that's the power measurement, or volts per meter. So, and there's various ways that you and I could make a rather simple sniffing antenna. If I take a piece of semi-rigid coax cable and take the center conductor and curve it into a loop of maybe a half-inch diameter, take the end of that piece of wire and solder it back to the shield, I've now got a sniffing loop, and that has a calculatable amount of area and gain. And so now you hold that near the source of your signal and put that into a receiver of which has got a calibrated signal strength meter. And there's various ways you can calibrate your signal strength meter. Well, how many milliwatts is going into your radio when it reads S9? Well, in theory, you can take a signal generator and start turning up the dial and putting in signals until your radio reads S9. The signal strength meter on most of our radios is very poorly calibrated. Let me drop this. But by way of a signal generator, you can calibrate any radio you own. I've actually done that on some of my radios, and I used to tell people how many microvolts of signal I'm getting at 432 because they sent a signal to me. I used to keep a card file of all the 450 guys that I kept a card file on that I used to have on contacts at 432 in the early 70s. And as people would make a change of their antenna amplitude or the gain of their antenna or the power output of their transmitter, they would get me on the air and say, how many microvolts am I giving you today, Dick? And I would give them a number, and they'd go away saying, okay, I'm getting 10 microvolts of signal from you here in Huntington now. And it used to be 5 microvolts, so I can tell you've made a 6 decibel improvement in the power output that you're radiating with your antenna, with your current transmitter. So the units that are used for field strength measurement are a little bit unfamiliar to the average ham radio operator. Methods of making it and calibrating it and sending it and being traceable to the Bureau, a little bit difficult. But let me worry, let me stop you worrying about how many decimal places of error you need. Let me drop. You're actually... You actually go through that calculation in almost any of the situations we encounter, and you'll find out that the safety factor you've got in almost all situations is 10 to 1, 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1 safety factor. You didn't know about it, but it's an awful lot of the things that you think are dangerous, you actually go through the calculation, you'll be amazed how safe it really is. Therefore, even though you've got a little bit of error in the way you calibrated your signal strength meter, your S meter on your receiver, maybe the signal generator you used wasn't extremely well calculated. Maybe you've got 30% error, and you would now lose a whole lot of sleep over that. In most cases, you don't have to lose sleep, because when you finally figure out the ballpark of the number you're going to get from your equipment, in most cases, you've got a 50 to 1 or 100 to 1 safety factor, and so if you've got 10% of error on that, it's spinning in the ocean, if you know what I mean. There's a lot more to this story. You probably have additional questions on this one, Ed. I think you can find out an awful lot about what you're worrying about is anywhere near as much of a danger as you think, particularly because RF radiation should never have been called radiation. It should have been called radio signaling, radio communication. It should have been used any other word other than radiation because of that unfortunate association with nuclear radiation. And to compare nuclear radiation to radio radiation, let me drop it. You're not comparing an apple to an orange. You're comparing an apple to a pencil. I mean, they're entirely different phenomena. Nuclear really consists of real microscopic bullets that really penetrate and do damage. Radio is only a wave, and that wave, when it gets absorbed by human tissue, creates some heating. But the amount of heating you can recreate, the majority of your body can tolerate a tremendous amount of heating. Something like 1,000 watts of solar energy is hitting your body when you lay on the beach and the sun is shining on you at high noon, and your body can easily dissipate that. And here we're talking about milliwatts per square centimeter of potentially danger to a human eye. So the majority of your body has got this beautiful blood flow, that's got this cooling fluid that can tolerate local heating, if you know what I mean. Except for the human eye, you've got to be a little bit careful about that one. There's a lot more to the story, but maybe you've got a little bit of a hint of what's going on here, Ed. Darn good question. And we're not going to settle this in one session. It's going to take a couple of sessions. When it comes to radio biohazard, let me drop it. That question comes up on the TechNet every few months, maybe once every 6 months. We've discussed various portions of this situation probably at least 10 times in the past. And each time we explain it a little bit differently, a certain number of people who listen to the TechNet will say, I've heard this one before. That's a repeat subject. I don't want to hear it again. Well, because so few of us have got a good understanding of it. And by the way, my understanding is coming from 30 years of experience at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, in which on a number of occasions on the super high power Air Force and Navy transmitters that are on the B-1 bomber and on the EA-6B stand-up jammer that are radiating zillions of watts, so to speak, with a very high efficiency microwave antennas. Quite often on the testing of that equipment, I'm one of the people that was frequently asked to do an assessment of the next test that we're about to do in a chamber. Is it safe for the human beings that are nearby? And so I've been involved in some of these situations, and as you can see, converting it into easily understood language is not as easy as I'd like it to be. You're probably going to have additional questions, and that's perfectly all right, Ed. K2PYT, KC2PYT, K2RIW.
NY2HF, what a comment.
KC2PYT. Okay, well, my question was actually less about the biohazard and more about compliance. You know, as an attorney with a physics background, that's really, you know, the issue that's striking me about this, because I was looking at the FCC guidelines on this subject matter. And if you are transmitting on VHF, and you're doing it with more than 50 watts, there is mandatory routine evaluation, and you have to actually check by some method what the field strength is. And so part of my question was, A, how to do that? And the other part was, does anyone actually do that? Because I've never heard of somebody going through the effort when they hit 51 watts on VHF to be compliant to that degree. And then also one minor quibble on the physics. Gamma rays are both nuclear radiation and electromagnetic radiation. They're way, way up on the electromagnetic spectrum, but they are released by nuclear fission. And so I think that it is proper to call them radiation.
Yeah, when you ask about 50 watts versus 51 watts, you're speaking like an attorney, which you are, and I understand that. But because the safety factor in almost all situations is so big that whether or not you're running 51 watts or 510 watts is a real threshold of concern. If you are within a very small number of feet of an antenna on VHF, if you're running a dipole on a VHF frequency, and your dipole, for whatever reason, is mounted at eye level of altitude, where people could, in theory, run close to it, walk close to it, then you should worry about these measurements, if you know what I mean. You go through that calculation, you're going to find out that at 5 feet, I can do the calculation for you. If it was a dipole at 50 watts, at 470 megacycles, how many feet away are you going to be exceeding the number? It's going to be something in the vicinity of 5 feet. So if your dipole is at eye level and people can get within 5 feet of it, you're creating a slightly dangerous situation. None of us puts our 450 megacycle dipole 8 feet off the ground where people can walk there. For a whole bunch of reasons, we want good radio communication over a 10, 50, 30 mile range. You're going to mount the antenna a good number of feet in the air, and people can't get there unless they're climbing the tower and sitting right in front of your antenna at the time you're transmitting. And that's a very rare situation, if you know what I mean. Let me drop.
Hey, to again.
Yeah, we're going to pick up Dennis and Eric in that order. So in the case of Eric's broadcast transmitter, where he's radiating kilowatts of energy, again, that's safe because the antenna is 300 feet in the air. So the combination of...
Repeater, timeout.
The combination of numbers like 50 watts and an eye-level antenna is somewhere you would do the calculation. But you know that the number number is going to come out in the vicinity of 5 feet of so-called dangerous range. And your antenna is going to be a hell of a lot more than 5 feet away from human beings where they're normally located and where your antenna is located. So in that situation, we're being academic if we worry about 50 watts versus 51 watts when you've got probably 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 safety factor. Dennis, let's see what you've got to ask or add to this. NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis. Make sure you wait for the beeps.
Thank you, Dick. NY2HF, I just wanted to say that was the best explanation I've ever heard of the radiation from ham radio. Great, you know, because everybody thinks that, you know, what we're doing here is going to affect the population around us and the, you know, and ourselves. And I just thought that was great. I really, my hat's off to you. Great, great. You know, keep it up, Dick. You really put some stuff forward that people should hear. And I'll turn it back to the net.
Yeah, I'm rather glad to hear you say that, Dennis, because you're one of the very frequent contributors to the TechNet. I suspect that if I kept a report card on NY2HF, I'd find out that 80% of the time he listens to all the TechNets. As such, you'd be one of the first people who could make a valid complaint that, hey, you guys are repeating subjects. I've heard that before. I don't want to hear it anymore. Well, when it comes to radio frequency biohazard, I don't think we can discuss it too much. The cell phones that we use, the cell phone base stations, almost everybody is a NIMBY when it comes to a cell phone base station. If a base station was being mounted on the property adjacent to your house, 99% of the population would be very alarmed by that. And the next thing that's really amazing is that as close as you can possibly get to a cell phone base station, compared to holding that cell phone in your hand up against your ear, the energy from that cell phone is safe. But the amount going into your head with that cell phone against your head is more than 1 million times greater than if you lived directly next door to the cell phone base station and your bedroom is on the second floor of the house and your window directly faces the cell phone hardware. You take a field strength measurement from that second floor bedroom facing the cell phone at drive time when the cell site is working at maximum energy. You take a field strength measurement, and then you get on your cell phone and you report that measurement to your buddy. The amount of energy getting into your head from the cell phone in your hand is more than a million times greater because of the inverse square law. In one case, it's inches away versus 200 feet away is the closest you can get, and you're outside of the antenna pattern. So everybody worries about the cell phone base station. Let me drop. If you're concerned about the aesthetics of the cell phone base station and what it's going to do to your property value when you want to resell the house, yes, you've got a valid complaint. But when it comes to the biohazard of the cell phone base station, it's the safest thing in the world. It only radiates numbers like 30 watts. The antenna is 100 feet in the air, and the antenna has got a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. So you're under the umbrella of the antenna. You're a long distance away from it in altitude. You're a long distance away from it in range. And it's safe as all hell, if you know what I mean. Eric, because you're involved with really high power transmitters, in theory, you have to make that calculation. In theory, you're on the hook to be responsible for the field strength coming off your broadcast antenna that's a couple of hundred feet high, in theory, radiating kilowatts of power. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Tell us about that, Eric.
NWS2M for comment.
You're on the list. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RW, K2J. Well, we're not talking about kilowatts. We're talking about megawatts. Nine-tenths of a megawatt in my case. When I get people climbing up the tower, I'll let them go about 10 feet under the antenna. After that, I've got to switch to an antenna that's below them or go off the air because it's just way too much energy. But interestingly enough, when the Twin Towers were up on the World Trade Center, there was a big block of what we call the Red Zone on the South Tower, which had the observation deck. We really don't want to stand there for more than a half hour or so. I don't remember what the values were with this. It's like 10 times the acceptable level, but it's a very small area. At Empire, on the 86th floor, there's a couple of small spots where you don't really want to be hanging out. But then again, you are talking about megawatts of power above your head. So, you know, the guys will actually work 2 feet away from a television broadcast antenna and not really care about it. So, you know, we are talking about non-ionizing radiation, which is the kicker for most people when they hear that word radiation. They don't know the difference between ionizing and not ionizing. But when you do have a cluster of high-powered broadcast transmitters, you do exceed values, and then they sort of automatically get grandfathered, so to speak, because it's not as much energy as you think it is. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I've got to add a couple of words to what Eric just said. When he talks about megawatts, he's talking about effective isotropic radiated power coming off his antenna. His antenna has got lots of decibels of gain, so if I put 10 watts of power into a 10 dB gain antenna, 10 dB is a 10 to 1 ratio, 10 watts I'm putting into it, the effective power antenna is 100 watts. In other words, you stand a long distance